Welcome to Chip Chat, an interview series that connects you with technology experts around the issues that industry is focused on today. And now your host, Allison Klein.
Welcome to Chip Chat. My name is Allison Klein. Today I've got Brian David Johnson in the studio. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Brian, you are one of those unique people at Intel that, from what I can tell, are paid to think big thoughts and then write them down. Can you tell us what your day job is?
So I am Intel's futurist, and I'm also a director of future casting. So it's really my job to come up with a vision for computing in the year 2020 or 2021.
And how does one train to be a futurist? Do you just go through life thinking about the future as a wee lad and then come up through the ranks?
Yeah, possibly a lot of daydreaming and a lot of reading science fiction, which basically means a lot of people at Intel actually could become futurists.
Exactly.
No, a lot of it actually has to do with history. I mean, I think most of the time you read about looking into the future and doing projections is you've got to have a good, strong understanding of sort of technology history and of media history and things like that. But also it's about communication. So you have to have the chops in engineering as well. That's just the price to get in the door at Intel.
Sure.
But also being able to have a vision for where we might be going, have a process to validate it, and then be able to communicate it to people.
Obviously, Intel develops technologies for the future. We drive innovation. But why do we need a futurist?
You know, we live in the house of Moore's Law, right? I mean, the work that we do, we literally build the future at Intel. But it's very, very pragmatic. It sounds a bit like science fiction, but we all know inside of Intel that to build the chip, to build the processor, takes about 5 to 10 years for the planning. So for me, looking at 2020 and 2021, it's incredibly pragmatic.
And so how do you get started?
So the process is called future casting.
Mm-hmm.
The first step is about really looking and getting a deep understanding of people. Ultimately, it's about the consumers and our customers interacting and using our platform. So it starts with a base of social science research. And then the next step is pulling in all the really cool stuff that we're doing in our labs and all the stuff that's going on in the business group. So getting an understanding of where technology is going. And then we kind of mix that with trend data. So all the stuff that everybody else does, you have mega trends, you have government reports, kind of where population is going, where bandwidth is going, kind of all the regular stuff.
Sure.
We kind of bang that together and then come up with things like these books.
Mm-hmm.
We come up, sometimes we even come up with things like science fiction stories that get these visions for what the future might be like, and then we put them in front of people and test them.
That sounds like fun. We brought you in today because you actually did write a book that has been getting a lot of interesting press called Screen Future. Tell us about it.
So, as you said, it's called Screen Future, the future of entertainment, computing, and the devices we love. And it's really a work of futurism looking out at the year 2015. But it really uses television as a lens to look at computing. The idea behind the book is saying, what if entertainment, so entertainment being that mix of TV, movies, games, social networking applications, what if that was the primary thing that everybody was going to do with all of Intel's products, from the data centers to digital home to handheld smartphones, tablets, whatever, that it was all going to be about entertainment. So you can imagine saying that about 5 or 6 years ago inside of Intel, people wanted to show me the door, right? We're
sure.
Intel, where we do serious work around serious computation. And I think to the credit of some of the folks in management, especially Justin Ratner, who's been a huge supporter of the book, he said, why don't you go look at that? Why don't you go push on that? So this book is really a collection of that research.
What did you learn about the stickiness of TV versus computers?
People love TV. People all over the world love TV. And we have a connection with TV. And this came from the social science research, right? This came from Dr. Bell and all the other anthropologists, that TV has a place in our lives like no other piece of technology. Television is literally the center of people's homes, right?
Mm-hmm.
It sits at the center of their living room. For some people, it's the center of their bedroom. For a lot of people, TV is the center of their day. They plan their day around TV, and especially around things like sporting events and things like that. It's a big, big deal. But I think it goes even deeper than that. And an example I like to use is there's always that scene in sort of those end-of-the-world movies where the main character turns on the TV, and you kind of get that blank line where it says, you know, the station is off the air. You get that noise. And you know at that moment that the end of days have come, that everything has gone to hell because there is no TV.
Right.
Imagine that happening like when you went to a local website. You know, it doesn't signal the apocalypse when, you know, you can't get onto Google, you can't get on the New York Times. And I think that speaks to this really rich relationship that we have all over the world with television, but thinking about television as a technology. So just as we would think about computing or smartphones or the big iron up in the sky, all of that, just think about it as yet another screen, basically. A smartphone becomes a very viable television platform. A PC becomes a viable television platform. Because you have all these screens, because there's the intelligence of the computer inside of them, it will begin to change what we watch, how we find it, how we interact with it, and how we tell our friends about it.
With more screens, does that mean more media? More choice?
It's being able to choose certain podcasts, being able to choose certain sort of online TV shows, which we're seeing only more and more of them. I mean, CES, as you walked the floor, you saw so many of those folks running around with cameras, and those people have an audience, and it's actually becoming more viable. But with all of that said, there's always going to be a market for big budget entertainment. Now, that doesn't mean there's not room for both, and I think that's going to be for all of us, the challenge is keeping both of those ideas in our head, that it can be about huge, big budget, mainstream entertainment, and it can also be about intensely personal Facebook-like entertainment as well.
What do you think is Intel's role beyond just the technology provider?
I think Intel has a very rich history of igniting and exciting the ecosystem. And there's the work that we do directly with our customers, certainly. There's the work that we do with the ecosystem. I think we're one of the pioneers in being able to kind of go out and work with the ecosystem in a way that a lot of other companies don't.
Mm-hmm.
It's just because it's so paramount to our work that, you know, we're creating sort of the silicon and the platforms and these basically the soil to grow these experiences. But there's so many other factors, and I think we've understood that as a corporation for a long time.
Well, I can't wait to hear more. We'll have to have you back.
I would love to come back.
And thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thanks, Allison.
Visit ChipChat online at intel.com/design/chipchat.htm.